Thanks for listening to Bullseye. We'd like to better understand who's listening and how you're using podcasts. Please help us out by completing a short anonymous survey at npr.org/podcast survey. One word. It takes less than 10 minutes. It really helps support the show. That's npr.org/podcast survey. One word.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
I'm Jesse Thorne. It's Bullseye. If you're looking for something to stream these days, maybe a reason to laugh, I have a recommendation. A comedy special called Bangin' by Nikki Glaser. It is so funny. Nikki is, of course, an accomplished stand-up comic. She has also hosted shows on Comedy Central and MTV. She makes regular appearances in all the roasts. If you've seen her in one of those, you probably remember her delivering the most devastating cutting joke in a night dedicated to devastating cutting jokes. A lot of her stand-up is about sex, so we'll be talking a lot about sex in the interview. If you or someone you're with might be sensitive to that, just a heads up that is what we're chatting about. Anyway, let's kick things off with a clip from her stand-up special, Bangin'. She's talking about how she often felt like she wasn't pretty enough as a child.
I kind of had an idea that I wasn't that cute, you know, because I had a really beautiful sister growing up, never went through an awkward phase. She would just, so stunning. She literally would stop traffic when I pushed her in front of it and tried to get her out of the way. And I'm the second prettiest sister, and then there isn't another one, but so I've got that. But people would stop my mom as a child and tell my mom that my sister should be a model, like, right in front of me and be like, this child needs to be a model. And they wouldn't see me at first, and then I'd emerge from behind my mom's legs like Nosferatu, like, what should I be? Just, like, desperate to be discovered or whatever. And they're like, you should be you're going to be a model train enthusiast, probably. I think you should start collecting soon.
Nikki Glaser, welcome back to Bullseye. It's really nice to talk to you again.
It's nice to talk to you again. Thank you for having me.
When you were putting this special together, did you have 20 minutes of sexual material that we can't talk too specifically about on National Public Radio? Or did you develop 20 minutes of sexual material that we can't talk too specifically about on National Public Radio in order to make this special?
I already had it. I mean, it was, that's already what I don't ever write material for anything specifically when it comes to stand up. I'm never like, well, this is going to be a special that says this, or it's just whatever is interesting to me at that time. So this hour of material on Bangin' is what is just I just picked an hour out of like 2 hours of material I'm always doing and kind of like was like, oh, I guess these are similar themes. But it all is the same. I've been talking about the same stuff for my whole career. I realize I'm just getting better at doing it. But I have the same interest. Like you watch any of my specials and it's just a younger person just dealing with the same stuff. It's just, I'm just getting older. My act stays the same age and I just keep getting older.
I think there's a lot of stand-up comedy about sex, and there has been for quite a long time. I think yours is a little different. Do you notice that you talk about different things about sex on stage relative to, you know, the other folks that you see doing 15-minute sets before and after you?
Yeah, I don't really notice that, to be honest with you. I'd have to have someone kind of tell me how mine is different. I know that I talk about it more. It's a subject that comes up more to me, but I've never really examined it or judged it because it's never felt forced. And as long as something's not kind of me trying to be something, there's no need for me to like analyze it and be like, why am I doing this? It just is like, it's just how I think. And it is interesting to me though, that I'm kind of known as this sex comic when I have less sex than anyone I know. And I've had less sexual partners than anyone I know. I mean, I'm really not someone who should be even talking about these things. And I think that's why I talk about them so much, is because I am so scared of it. I talk about what I'm scared of.
I mean, I think that sex is a topic that you can go to on stage because it has a lot of punch, and a lot of comics use it that way. And some do a really particularly great job. One of the things that I was impressed with about your special is that with the sheer volume of sex jokes, and some of them really are jokes, you know, I mean, you're a great writer of jokes. That's how you become a celebrated roast performer. You know, you take a premise and write 40 jokes about it, and four of them are perfect and you use those.
Yes.
But I think there's something kind of sweet about the sex jokes in your special, which caught me by surprise every single time. I mean, it caught me by surprise for 20 straight minutes to open the special, you know, like, and your sex jokes are vulnerable, but it's not just that. I think I'm just so used to seeing people tell jokes about sex that are like,
yes, I think I know what you're saying. I think, yeah, they're so in your face. They can be so gross. And I could be pretty disgusting. I mean, it's hard to talk about sex without being kind of viscerally unpleasant at times. But it's never my intent to, like, gross someone out. It's just, like, my intent, if I gross someone out, is to be like, can you believe we do this? And that's what I think so much of my sense of humor stemmed from, is, like, growing up in a house and growing up in a community that, like, we didn't talk about sex. I didn't know anything about it. It was very shameful. And I was so curious about it. I was always met with complete silence whenever I asked my parents about their sex life, which I did as a kid. I was always, like, curious about what sex was and, like, who was having it and when and what did it look like and why. And my parents would just, like, ignore me. They wouldn't even be like, we don't talk about that. They would just pretend they didn't hear me. The time I remember that was the most awkward was I was probably, like, 9, and I just had the realization that perhaps my parents had been with people before each other, like, that they didn't begin with me. And so I remember just kind of, we were on a long road trip, and it was the beginning of a road trip. My cousins were in the minivan, my mom, my dad in the front seat. And I just go, Dad. And he's like, yeah. And I'm like, did you ever have sex with someone besides before mom? And I swear to you, no one said anything. It just, we just drove in silence until the next rest stop. And then we could all talk again. Like, it was that weird. And so I learned early on that, like, there was something that I was kept from. There was some world that I didn't get to know about that sounded, like, so good because people aren't talking about it. Like, what are they hiding? And then as soon as I was able to have sex and my friends were starting to have sex, it turned into a real fear of it, that I was going to be bad at it, that I just was, as fascinated as I was by it, I was terrified of it. And I think those go hand in hand, and it continues to be that for me. I mean, my special really talks about the difference between being someone who drinks and someone who doesn't when you have sex. And I think a lot of younger kids, I think a lot of people have sex because they're able to get drunk enough to do it, but I don't drink anymore. And so I'm kind of exploring having to have sex again. I feel like I'm a child, like a preteen again, of, like, how do you even do this? So I'm constantly reexamining that, like, curiosity and the feeling that I'm kind of left out from it.
Did you have the same fear and discomfort around romance that you had around sex as an adolescent, like a teenager?
I think that is what I'm more scared of now. The idea, I used to yearn for that as a kid. Romantic comedies. I'm a sucker for all of them. You've Got Mail is my favorite movie. I love romance. I've never been in a relationship in which it has been shown to me in any way. I choose people that have no interest in being romantic with me. So there is some kind of, I think that's my real fear now, is of sex, intimacy, but romance. I have pretty bad self-esteem, as most comedians do. I just tend to admit it and talk about it a little bit more because I don't like it. And it's hard for me to convince myself that someone, like, the idea of romance is like, really me? Why me? Like, I just feel like whenever someone's like attracted to me sexually, I even question that. I'm just like, I just feel like I'm too goofy for that. So I just feel like, I really do feel like a clown most times of like, why would you want to, you know, can I say the F word on here? I'm so sorry. Why would you want to have sex with a clown?
I mean, you already did.
I did. I really did. So you can is the answer. May you? Different answer. I won't again.
We will have bleeped it out.
Okay. Well, I won't again because I'm trying to be better about cussing. But yes, I feel like a preteen clown most of the time. I really do. I feel like just awkward middle schooler, like brace face. And so now I'm cool. I'm in the cool kids. Like, I'm finally popular. I'm at the popular lunch table, but I didn't get there the way I wish I would have, which is like just by being attractive enough that people like you. I mean, that's what my whole next special is about, is like, you know, and you heard in that clip, it's just feeling like, man, things would be a lot easier if I was a lot prettier. And I resent it. And I know I'm pretty, but like, I still struggle with it.
I mean, you went into the field where, I mean, if you're going to go into the entertainment industry, maybe radio is a even better example, but yeah. Comedy, stand-up comedy is pretty much the one where you can go into it being moderately good looking, and you get up on a stand-up comedy stage, you're the best looking person anybody's seen all night, you know?
Yes, that was intentional. I mean, I don't think it was intentional, but like I say, I'm a comedy nine, but like, take me out of comedy and I'm clinging to a mid-range seven most days, and that's fine. It just is what it is. But yes, I tend to get more attention for being an attractive, you're attractive for a comedian. I'm like, no kidding. I chose this for like, I needed to, I needed to pick something where I'd stand out. And yeah. And I'm not kidding you, Jesse. As soon as I could, as soon as I started aging, which you start, I've been aging forever, obviously. But like, as soon as I started feeling aging, I was like, I couldn't have sprinted quicker to a radio show and building my broadcasting skills, because I know where it's going as a woman. My face is falling. And as much as we love our Frances McDormands and our Meryl Streeps, and then after that, we run out of examples because people, like, Hollywood does hate older women, and you can't convince me otherwise. There are exceptions always. It's just not a good show. Hollywood's not a good place to be as a woman. And that's why I do radio and stand up. It's the only place where you're allowed to kind of age, but not even.
One of the things about stand-up comedy is that when you are a stand-up comedy performer, the feedback loop is like very clear and direct. It's very easy to distinguish between people laughing at your joke and people not laughing at your joke. And you started stand-up comedy pretty young. And I wonder if that was part of the appeal for you, that here was a place where at least, even if you know, most people aren't especially great when they start stand-up comedy, but even if you're not especially great, you can at least figure out what you can do that people definitely like, and you can tell because they told you by laughing at it.
Yes, it's that immediate response that these people like me. My sense of humor grew out of the fact that I had a raging eating disorder when I went to school and my freshman year, and I had no friends and no one wanted to be friends with me because I looked so sick. And I just developed, I didn't even mean to, but I just became really funny because I was like, I gotta create a diversion from people thinking I need help, because I wanted to like be in my disease. I didn't want help. I didn't want to make everyone worried about me. So I just became really funny. And that's what led me to stand up, because people said, you should do stand up. You're funny. And then as soon as I tried stand up, that you're the exact thing you're talking about, the validation, the laughter, the we like you, I felt it wash over me immediately. I knew exactly what I wanted to do the rest of my life. It was like a drug, and it continues to be like a drug. I mean, I don't know that stand up has been all of that. It's given me so many riches in life, but it's also caused me a lot of pain, because I have become obsessed with it. And until this quarantine, I needed to do it every single night. And if I didn't, I felt some sort of deficiency. I felt less than, because it was also the first time, and I had been searching for to be something interest to be special at something. I was smart, but I wasn't the smartest. I was good at swimming. I wasn't the best. I just was always so freaking average. And the first time I did stand up, I was good. Like, I just had a knack for it. And it was undoubtedly like what I should be doing. Like, everything, it was first time something clicked and I was like, okay, yes, I'm finally good at something. I finally am special in some way. And I think that that's what a lot of stand-ups are seeking, is like they just didn't feel special growing up and they finally do. And now I'm addicted to it, like completely addicted to the spotlight. And I realize that it's empty, and a lot of times it's fulfilling in beautiful ways, but it's still something that isn't real. You know, it's not real love, the cheers from a crowd or the laughter. It's not like that didn't save me during this. My fans didn't save me during the quarantine. I had to go back home with my parents. Like, it's not real love. So I'm realizing that it's kind of empty, and especially having to be away from it. I'm like, okay, I got to find something new.
Working comics, you know, a big part of a working comics life, most working comics, is sets. Like, what sets have you got? How many sets have you got tonight? How many sets have you got this week? How much stage time do you have this week? And that is not a possibility for anybody.
Right. No, I'm thinking the same thing. I have more of a handle over it now, and I've been doing it so long, and I've gotten burnout from doing it so many times in terms of like just repetition, set. And then I just show up at a club crying because I'm so tired and I don't even know what to say. And I've had those, I always like overdose and I need like intervention. And I was about to hit one right before this quarantine, but I'm seeing comics who haven't been through it before and are really addicted to it kind of spiraling out. And I worry about them because these are really lonely men who are not in touch with their feelings and have no intention to be in, come in touch with their feelings. And they don't realize that the hours, these guys that used to do, you know, 7-hour sets back in the day, like Chappelle would go on stage, people would be like, he did 7 hours, or Dane Cook would do like 4 hours at the Comedy Store. I never was that impressed by that, to be honest with you. I've always thought that was kind of sad. And I know Dane well, and he'd probably admit it too. Like, you just don't want to get off stage because you don't want to feel your feelings. You don't want to be back in your life. It's numbing. And for me, it's totally a drug. And so much so that I've seen it parallel other things I've been addicted to in my life. Like, right before the quarantine, I was getting on stage. And I would say for the past 3 years, I've gone on stage every single night. At least, you know, because if you add up the multiple sets I do, I just never take a night off. And I got to the point where I would get off stage and someone would go, how was that? And it would be, I was just 30 seconds ago on stage, and they're in the other room, so they don't know. And I'd say, I don't know. I couldn't even tell you. I wasn't even, the high wouldn't even last to the next room. And it used to be the high would last weeks because you only get on stage once every 2 weeks at the open mic. And now it wouldn't last after I hung up the mic. Like, it was only in the moment that it would feel good. And it was starting to feel like not even good then. I could be on stage and thinking about something totally different. So it kind of got away from me, even though it was still something I was doing every night. This has allowed me a chance to reflect and be like, what do I love about it? And what do I want to do when I go back on stage?
Have you had any insight in that reflection?
The biggest insight I've had is I don't really miss it, to be honest with you. I've really gotten my fill from doing radio and from doing podcasts. Like, I feel like I've gotten what I need to out of my system in terms of being creative, and I'm spreading the message I want to spread. I'm still getting to exercise my ability to joke right and to perform a set by doing things like Bill Maher or going on Conan. Like, there are outlets for me to do organized comedy that isn't just, you know, stream of consciousness radio or podcasting. But stand-up itself, I don't miss it. And I think, to be honest with you, Jesse, I think a part of the reason I am not dying to do stand-up is because no one else is doing it. And as soon as the gates open again and we are able to do it, I'll be back at it whether I want to or not, because the compulsion to do stand up for me is a compulsion to not fall behind, to not be eclipsed. There's only room for so many. You got to stay good. The reason I'm good is because I've just worked my tail off, and I'm so scared of I go out every night and do a set because I think about, okay, if I'm not doing the set, someone else is doing that set and they're going to get better and I'm not. And right now I'm like fine with it because no, everyone's bad right now. Like, so I saw someone tweet recently, like, we're all going to have to learn how to do stand up again. And I'm like, yeah, it is a muscle. It is yes, you'll have muscle memory, but we're all going to be starting from scratch again. And it's kind of delightful. If I was like, you know, holed up with broken legs or something and I couldn't do stand up, I would be having a much worse time than the fact that no one can do it.
We'll continue my conversation with Nikki Glaser after a quick break. In just a minute, we'll talk about her work at Comedy Roasts, including maybe the most savage joke she has ever told in public. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
There's more than one science story out there. If you've ever wondered, hummingbird tongues, how do they work? Was the movie Twister scientifically accurate? Or what moons are the best moons? Listen and subscribe to Shortwave, NPR's daily science podcast.
If you want to make ends meet in a hip town, the kind with great coffee, lots of dog parks, you're gonna need a side hustle. In Brooklyn, maybe you drive rideshare. In Fairhaven, it's more like, well, it's more like slaying psychic beasts with your custom balanced throwing knives.
Hey, are you from Hunter?
I guess so. Hold on, I have to ask you some stuff. Are you hurt?
No.
Do you feel yourself developing strange powers?
I mean, I saw a ghost once.
Okay, I'm gonna put down no.
Okay.
So, you're having some sort of monster issue.
Oh, it's like a pod, I guess? Here it is. Is that what you call it? Like a pod?
Yeah, pod works.
Oh, it's opening!
Morgan leaps back and positions the metal spear she's been carrying on her back. She points it towards the bug, which swipes the spear away just as an electrical bolt fires from the tip. It hits the gate to a petting zoo, and a bunch of baby goats come streaming out.
Can we just take a moment to appreciate how cute this is?
It's great. I hope someone's filming it.
Oh my god. I just love baby goats.
Bubble, the sci-fi comedy from MaximumFun.org. Just open your podcast app and search for Bubble.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest, Nikki Glaser, is a stand-up comic and podcast host. Her latest stand-up special, Bangin', is streaming now on Netflix. You mentioned briefly that some time ago you quit drinking. Why did you quit drinking?
I really just saw everyone's career who I wanted and who were the most successful driven people. And I just saw that they kind of all had a commonality of being sober from alcohol. At least I just started, like, I don't know. I think it was, or they just at least didn't have a problem with it. They weren't getting drunk every night. And then all the comedians I was getting drunk with every night, they just seemed like nothing ever really grew for them. Like I just noticed a pattern from my friends. And this was when I was 27, and I was also just drinking every night because you can. You're at a bar and you get free drinks and you're broke, so you just want to drink the pain away of, like, just being broke. You know, it turned into a problem for me. I wasn't doing anything belligerent. I wasn't putting my life at risk, but I just, oh, you know what it was? It was really like the hangover. I think if I still could get drunk without suffering a hangover, I probably would, and my life would be way worse than it is now. But the hangover was a real thing that I had to quit, because I just had a come to Jesus moment. I had a really bad hangover one morning, and I just was like, I feel like I'm dying. Like, this is the worst I've ever felt in my life. And no one feels sorry for me. You know, it's this you did it to yourself kind of thing. Like, oh, you're hungover. Like, screw you. Like, no one cares. The best part about being sick is being babied and nurtured. It's just being hungover, you get none of that. There was no good I could see from it. So I read a book and then I stopped from after I read a book. And then I was done with it. And then, you know, my addictions switched to like a million different things that I still struggle with, but nothing that is as disabling in the short term is alcohol. I think I dodged a bullet with that one.
Did stopping drinking give you perspective on the role that drinking had played in your life when you were drinking?
Yes. Especially when it comes to sex and dating. Like, I didn't know when I quit drinking that I would not be hooking up anymore. Like, it was the only reason I was ever able to be close to anyone or let someone in or like be that intimate was that I was inebriated. Like, it helped me get to that point. So when I quit drinking, I didn't see that was going to be a fallout of it. And then all of a sudden I was like, oh, I haven't even like made out with someone in a really long time. And that used to be like a thing I would do. And I was like, oh yeah, it's because you haven't been drunk. And so that was the biggest glaring thing that I noticed. And then the other thing was just, if you look at a chart of like my career and my life, it just, everything started going up from there. I was just able to function better and focus more. It was the best decision I made, but that doesn't mean that I am addiction free. I'm like someone who really struggles with a lot of stuff, but drinking was just one that with examples throughout my family, I could just see where it was going. I like was starting to remind myself of certain family members that their behavior really disturbed me as a child. And I was like, oh wait, I sound like that when I'm drunk. You know, you see enough pictures of yourself and all this, enough footage that it just, bottom line, it was getting in the way of my career. And I just, that always has come first for me.
Do you feel proud of how funny you are?
No. Yeah. I mean, yes, there are days where I'm like, yes, I'm so funny. I'm like one of the best. I like truly believe it. I feel it. You can't convince me otherwise. And then there are days, and it really is day by day. It's like a lot of days recently with the quarantine and me not getting the validation I so desperately desire, I've had this feel like I got asked to do Bill Maher last week. On Wednesday, they called me to do Thursday's show, like to tape it on Thursday. And I was like, did they know that I'm not Eliza Schlesinger? Like, do they know that they got the right person? I really did think there was a lapse of judgment, because why would I just think of myself as like kind of a dumb sex comic. Why am I going to be on the show with Al Gore? Like, it made me, as much as I should have been like, wow, this is such a cool opportunity, I can't believe the honor, I just felt like I had tricked someone or there had been some kind of mistake. And I'm still having having trouble thinking that it wasn't an error on some producer's part to book me. It's hard for me. It's daily. It goes from thinking I'm the best to thinking I'm a fraud.
Before we go, I want to talk to you a little bit about performing in roasts, which has been an extraordinarily successful part of your career. The roasts as they exist now, I mean, there are, I think at this point, a few competing roast battle television projects and stage shows. But generally speaking, we're talking about the roasts that happen on Comedy Central, in which B+, A- list celebrities are roasted by a series of very skilled joke comics, sometimes roast specialist comics, but mostly comics who are great at jokes. And they can be really, really funny. It's also a very odd thing. And I think I was most struck by that because I saw you tell an anecdote about doing the roast of Martha Stewart. And I don't think I'm going to stun anyone when I say that you had not previously socialized much with Martha Stewart.
Right. It was the roast of Rob Lowe, and she was one of the people on the dais. Yes.
There
and
you
I,
go.
No, I had never met her before.
And you met her backstage and kind of, in meeting her, had to decide what material you were comfortable with doing seconds later on stage.
Yes.
Or at least minutes later. And I thought, like, what a bizarre thing to try and decide what kind of jokes to do about somebody in this particular context where you are allowed to be mean, but also you remain a human being.
Yeah.
And like, there was a time when the whole idea of it was, look, at the end of the day, I really love you because you're my actual friend from real
right,
life.
Right.
And you could always go back to that deep knowledge of what was appropriate because you had a real deep relationship.
Yes. And here I am. She doesn't know me from any. She has no idea who I am. I mean nothing to her. And I'm going to get up there and just tell her who she is and make fun of the maybe things in her life that she's most ashamed of or, you know, and I go hard and I don't pull back and I try to go in a different direction than what everyone else is going to go in. And yeah, I had a kind of not an unpleasant exchange with her, but I just expected like, hey, we're on the same roast. Like maybe she would just be warmer. And I could just tell she's just maybe she maybe wasn't in that moment. She was nervous, whatever it was. I just didn't get a good vibe from her. So I was like, oh, okay, I'll go a little harder than I normally would. I feel like I'm more justified. The joke I wrote about her being a cold mother is probably true based on what I'm experiencing backstage right now. So I'm going to do that joke as opposed to not do it. But I mean, it is like you hit the nail on the head. It is weird. It is weird because you meet all these people at this like kind of, you know, half like cocktail party beforehand that they throw you all together and they're filming it and they're filming you guys interacting. It's so awkward. And then you go out there and you have these jokes that you've been working on. So I know what I'm going to say. And it's a whole different beast saying it in front of them. And then the commercial break when it's awkward again and everyone's just on stage, not, and there's no, you know, assistants up there. There's no one talking to the stars. Like makeup people aren't even on stage. You're just sitting next to the people. You just said the meanest thing about it. You don't even know them. I mean, it's so weird.
If it's true, does that make it okay?
Yes. I mean, I unless it's just like making fun of, you know, Caitlyn Jenner was on the last roast that I did and I had jokes about the car accident that she was in because I was told that, you know, nothing was off limits. And so I had a joke where I said, I go, Caitlyn Jenner, what a beautiful woman you hit with your car 5 years ago. Like I said something like that. And I didn't do the joke because I found out right before the show, like the morning of the show, they were like, if there's a joke about someone like her car accident, she'll walk off stage. And I was like, oh, okay, then I won't do those jokes. You guys should have told me sooner. It's never my intent to like make anyone upset, even if the joke is true, like if it's actually going to trigger them in that way. But if it's something like, I don't know, I feel like if you sign up for a roast, you just sign away any kind of right you have to be like, that hurts. You just don't have it. And I do the same thing, you know, all bets are off for me. Nothing's over off limits for me. And I've been really hurt before by jokes, like really hurt. And I still don't begrudge those comedians from making those jokes. I do, you know, when Bruce Willis is saying a joke that is just scathing about the way that you look, you kind of go, well, Bruce Willis didn't write that. What comedy writer in that back room was looking at my face and studied it long enough to come up with the fact that I look like Owen Wilson? Like it's, you start thinking like, how dare that writer? But I never get mad at anyone about the jokes. Like I can't. And I hope that they afford me the same, you know, leniency when it comes to like, I don't feel like a bad person when I do these, even though, man, I have to tap into that side of myself.
I want to play a joke from the time that you were on the dais for the roast of Rob Lowe.
God, I had such a crush on you when I was a little girl. If only I'd known that's when I had my best shot.
That is one of the most intense jokes I've ever seen on stage.
Yeah, it's really twisted. Well, you know, I don't know how that one came about. I mean, I guess it came about from the fact that like this guy is like such a heartthrob. And although that wasn't true to me that I didn't have a crush on him, he's someone that I would have had a crush on as a 13-year-old girl. And you know, when I was six, when I was underage, I dreamed of like being with Dave Matthews. Now, if that dream would have taken place, that would have been statutory, you know? So I think it just stemmed from me thinking about like, I dreamed of this guy back then. Oh, this also fits in with the fact that he had a sex tape with a girl that was really young, you know, like it all just lined up. And yeah, it's uncomfortable, but That one to me didn't even, it would not even cross my mind to not go there. Like didn't, no second guessing that one at all. I never think about these things until later on. And then I go, yikes, who made you think you could say that? Like that one was like, I would say in a level of difficulty or a level of going like, ugh, that one was like zero for me. I wouldn't have even batted an eye.
What is amazing to me about that joke, I mean, it's a great joke, you know, but so is you saying, you know, Jeffrey Ross's face has a dad bod or whatever.
Right.
Like that's also a really, like that's a similarly funny, like if it was just purely about joke.
Yeah.
That's similarly funny. I mean, I think the thing that makes it devastating is that it is a reminder of something that Rob Lowe did in real life that was deeply immoral and a horrible act. And maybe, he was a young man. We could probably say a horrible mistake. But nonetheless, like something really bad, like way worse than Martha Stewart
being
manipulating
an unloving
stocks.
Mother. Yes.
Or being, you know, although that's also bad. But
sure. No, you're absolutely right. Like, and I think it's my job to call, especially men who have been gross sexually in any way. And I forget the details of the Rob Lowe thing truly, but like, you know, I remember,
when he was a young man, when he was in his early 20s, there was a sex tape of him having sex with a 16-year-old girl. Yeah.
I mean, that makes me super uncomfortable. And the fact that I went there, but the thing is, I don't want to let people off the hook for anything. I didn't like when Peyton Manning was on the roast of, I believe it was Rob Lowe, and they told us we couldn't make fun of any sexual allegations against him. That was his like caveat for doing it, which he hasn't been charged with anything. I understood it, you know, I understood like, but the rumors were there and I just didn't really care. And so I wrote a joke about it and I did it and I knew it wouldn't air. There's no chance Comedy Central would air it. I knew Comedy Central would be upset with me about it in the moment, but I said it. I think I made some joke about him and doing something gross. And then I was like, the University of Tennessee paid me $16 million not to say. I made some joke about a payout he gave someone. I forget what it was, but I made a very cutting joke about his allegations. And I felt like, screw you. You don't get to misbehave like that and then say it's off limits. It's like, well, this did happen and a woman did lose her life. The reason I didn't want to do that is because there was a victim in the Rob Lowe one too. I mean, I don't know. I have no rules for myself. It's like, I do joke by joke, but I do have a heart and I don't want to bring up things that are going to trigger people or that are like, there are other victims involved. Like the car crash one, I felt bad because it was a joke like involving the woman who died and like her family didn't sign up to hear that. And so I was like, okay, I understand taking that joke out, but I don't let these guys off the hook very often. I can't. And I'm scared not to, but especially on these roasts, oh, come on. You're going to get it. Alec Baldwin, I'm going to make fun of you for being a short-tempered a-hole, you know, like it's, you can't avoid that. We're going to call it out. And so I do. And I hope that if I do anything illegal and do a roast someday, people call me out for it.
Well, Nikki Glaser, I so enjoyed your special and I'm so glad that you could come back on the show. And I hope we'll talk to you again sometime.
Thank you so much, Jesse. I loved it.
Nikki Glaser, her special Bangin' is extremely funny. She also hosts her own podcast, which you should check out. It's called You Up with Nikki Glaser. You can download it with your favorite podcatcher. That's the end of another episode of Bullseye. Bullseye is produced at the homes of me and the staff of Maximum Fun in and around Los Angeles, California, where my colleague Jesus captured in his house a shiny Pokemon. Now, a shiny Pokemon, my notes indicate, is a lot like a regular Pokemon, but in rare, different colors. this particular Pokemon was yellow instead of brown. So congratulations to Jesus. Hopefully he won't get a big head and quit his job. We're all on a journey. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer is Kevin Ferguson. Jesus Ambrosio is our shiny associate producer. We get help from Casey O'Brien and Jordan Cowling. Our interstitial music is by Dan Wally, also known as DJW. Our theme song is by The Go Team, thanks to them and their label Memphis Industries for letting us use it. We're also on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. Just search for Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. You can keep up with the show there. And I think that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.